Well, good evening and welcome. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the New York Society Library. It's great to see a big crowd here tonight. And first of all, we have to thank you all for making your way here through the troublesome traffic. We understand the president is in the city and they're lighting Christmas trees and doing other types of things in the city tonight. And it was causing a little bit of mayhem with everyone getting here. So thank you for coming out. This is our final event for November, and I think it's really going to be a special way to end our November season. I'm glad that you're able to be with us for our speaker, Amanda Foreman, author of A World on Fire. We do have copies of the book for sale, and Amanda tells me she's more than happy to autograph them after our talk this evening. A couple of small announcements. First, those of you who have one of these things, like me, a cell phone or a pager, please just take it out and silence it, if at all possible, for the benefit of everyone else in the room. We also record these events and stream them on the internet, so it's also for the courtesy of future viewers and listeners to the program. This is the time of year when we ask our members to support our annual fund. Your support is really critical to the success of all our programs, to our popular book discussion groups on E.M. Forster and Trollope, to our great and growing book collection of over 300,000 volumes, and the rest of the library's operations. I thank all of you who have contributed so far this year and urge the rest of you to do so as well. It's a real thrill to introduce our esteemed speaker this evening, particularly on the day when I understand the New York Times applauded this book as one of the 10 best nonfiction titles of 2011. So congratulations to Amanda. She is the award-winning historian and internationally best-selling author of Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, that was published back in 1998. And that year, she was the recipient of the very prestigious Whitbread Award for Biography. That book has been translated into a dozen languages and inspired a television documentary, a radio play starring Dame Judi Dench, and an Oscar-winning feature film that many of you have probably seen, The Duchess. Ms. Foreman's new book, A World on Fire, was published first of all in the United Kingdom in the fall of 2010 to great critical acclaim, and it was titled A World on Fire, an epic history of two nations divided. And then here in the United States, it followed with the publisher Random House this past June, and it was titled A World on Fire, Britain's Crucial Role in the American Civil War. Please join me in a warm welcome to Amanda Foreman.
Thank you very much, all of you, for inviting me here this evening. I've never actually been in this room before, so it's an amazing treat. Everyone's always said how beautiful the New York Society Library is, but I had no idea how completely beautiful it is. So thank you very much. Today is now almost the very end of my book tour. I've been traveling since June, and so it's rather nice to be back in New York, which for me is home. And on my way back to New York, I suppose I've had some time to reflect on some of the audiences I've encountered, some of the questions I've received about A World on Fire, and funnily enough, there's been one question that's come up every single time. And so I thought that I might preempt it this time by bringing it up myself. Because it's been noticed that I have a very strong English accent. And also that my first book was about an 18th century duchess, the Duchess of Devonshire, whereas this book is about the 19th century and the Civil War. And as one person put it to me recently at the Citadel in Virginia, he said, "Ma'am, I don't believe you can be an expert in both these subjects. One of them you must be a tourist in. So which one is it?" I can see why one might think that. So I thought that I might just very quickly outline to you why, at least for me, these two subjects are absolutely inextricably entwined around one single pillar. Because the journey actually started in New York, where I was an undergraduate at Sarah Lawrence. And when I was there, it was just when that sort of wave of student uprisings had started again, and we had a humdinger of a one, I have to say, that closed the campus for 2 months. We had no classes, and you know, there was lots of chanting and placard waving and things, and they had the usual complaints, you know. The cafeteria wasn't up to scratch, important stuff. But as well as those sorts of normal complaints, they also had one other general complaint, criticism really of the college, which was they wanted more diversity. Now, coming from an English boarding school, this idea of diversity was absolutely fascinating. I'd never encountered this thing before, and I certainly wanted to know more about it. And I realized after a few weeks that when they said this word diversity, it's like when there's a dog whistle words in politics. You know, you blow the whistle, but it means different things to different people. And I realized that the unspoken, but very clearly and genuinely felt criticism was the things that they had been taught at school, the promises of the civil rights movement, the promises from the Civil War, they felt had not been kept. And when they arrived at Sarah Lawrence, they looked around themselves and they were disappointed, more than disappointed. They were distressed, they were angry. And this was really what was driving the somewhat incoherent, inchoate student protest, although even not all of them realized that. But fundamentally, that's what it was about. Anyway, it was all resolved to some extent. Food did improve. And then we all graduated. And we all went on to do our things. But I have to say, for me, that was the defining moment of my intellectual and academic life. I never actually moved on from that point. I went to Oxford to do a master's on the abolition of the slave trade, and in particular, the politics behind the abolition of the slave trade. And then I embarked on a PhD on attitudes to race and colour in pre-Victorian England. I wanted to understand the teleology of what I had witnessed at Sarah Lawrence. I needed it to make historical sense to me. And while I was halfway through that dissertation, I was looking at the politician, a man called Charles Grey, who became Prime Minister, and he had proposed the motion to abolish the slave trade. So I was reading his life, and I was reading in particular his letters to his mistress, and his mistress's letters to her mistress, who was her husband's mistress. And I thought, oh my God, this is just too good to be true, you know. And then that became a different dissertation, and the book, The Duchess of Devonshire, and the play and the film. And so that was that. And of course, my publishers thought that I would stay in the 18th century with the wigs and the petticoats and things. But actually, that was never my plan. And while I was at Chatsworth, which is the great home of the Devonshires, I discovered something extraordinary about that family and the Civil War. And it was all because the then Duke of Devonshire had given me permission to look at absolutely everything. He said, look, I know you're not going to come back, at least not in the way you're here now, spending 3 months in the basement. So use it to your advantage. Go through every archive we have. And so I took him up on his offer and did. And I went through the 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th Duke. And it turned out that the 8th Duke of Devonshire, when he was a young man and he was the Marquis of Hartington, had actually had a very intimate connection to the war. And it was all because of a woman called Skittles. Now, Skittles was famous for two things, and they weren't, shall we say, unconnected. The first was that she drove a perfectly matched pair of horses. And the second was that she was incredibly expensive to maintain. And even though the Marquis of Hartington, who was at that point the richest bachelor in England, he suddenly found that he could no longer afford to keep her in the style she wanted to be accustomed to. And instead of, as we would say today, you know, manning up to the situation and perhaps suggesting that they sell one of the horses or both, you know, he just quietly one day packed his bags and sailed to America. And leaving no forwarding address. And when he arrived, he booked himself into the Fifth Avenue Hotel, which in those days was the most modern hotel in the world. You know, there were others that had more marble or whatever, but it was the hotel. And the Marquis was fascinated. What he loved about it was its what he called its vertical railway that took him from the ground floor up to his room. He thought it was fabulous, like that. And also, the other great thing, there was that when he called down using its very ingenious pipe system to order a cup of hot tea, it was brought to him hot. I mean, piping hot. So he was very happy at the Fifth Avenue Hotel. He was there for several weeks. And then one night at about 1 a.m, there was a knock on his door. And he was slightly surprised because he hadn't ordered anything that he can remember. But anyway, nevertheless, he opened the door. And it was not hot tea. It was Skittles. She had found him. She had somehow managed to track him all the way across the Atlantic and locate him at the Fifth Avenue Hotel. So, of course, he was delighted to see her. And he said they must obviously be together and that she should go back to her hotel, pack her bags, and join him in the morning. So she went back to where she was staying, and he packed his bags and booked a train to Washington, D.C. Because, you know, in those days, Washington wasn't, you know, it wasn't even built. It wasn't, you know, I mean, the dome had yet to be placed on the Capitol. Half its streets ended in the pile of rubble. He didn't think this was the kind of town that Skittles would want to go to. So he went to D.C. and he booked himself into Willard's Hotel, which was, you know, the nexus of power in Washington, which he liked. He found that fascinating. This was where, you know, politics, lobbying, and lawyering all coalesced together. What he did not like was the brown gobs of tobacco spit that he noticed lined the floors, the baseboards, and the door handles. This was something he'd not encountered in England before and thought it was a revolting habit. But otherwise, he had no complaints, loved American cocktails, couldn't get enough of them. And then after about 2 weeks, he was in his room and there was a knock on his door. And he was a bit nervous, I have to admit. You know, but he opened the door, it was Skittles. She had found him, amazingly, because he'd been keeping very quiet. She had located him at Willard's. So obviously, he was delighted to see her. He was absolutely delighted. And he said to her that they must be together for dinner. She should go back to her hotel, change for dinner, she was a little bit sceptical, but not completely so. He was so earnest about it. So she went back to her hotel and got ready for dinner. And in the meantime, he and a friend called Colonel Leslie rented a canoe. and went down to the Potomac, and because they thought, you know, it was 1862, that there was a war on, and although she might be able to sail across the Atlantic and get a train down to D.C., it would be unlikely that she'd be able to slip past the federal pickets to get into Virginia. So anyway, they paddled across the Potomac, got to the other side, and it was true. She could not and did not follow them. She just stayed on the banks, weeping like Dido, while they made their way down to Richmond. And here, something extraordinary happened, actually. Something even more powerful than Skittles. And that was Southern charm. And it just worked its magic on Hartington. He'd arrived in America completely pro-Northern. This was a man who was... He was a stalwart of the Liberal Party. He was a liberal politician, a man of liberal social opinions and liberal morals, shall we say. But utterly on the side of the North. And by the time he reached Richmond, though, and had spent several days in company of Southerners, he totally changed his mind. So much so that he attached himself to Robert E. Lee, and accompanied him to his headquarters. He was there after the Battle of Fredericksburg. He spent Christmas with them. Apparently, he made a great eggnog for the officers, so I'm told, and didn't leave the South until the spring of 1863. And then, when he returned to London, where he was appointed Under Secretary of War, very serious senior cabinet, junior cabinet position, he appointed himself the unofficial spokesman for the South. So a great coup for the pro-Confederacy lobby. But the weird thing is that his brother, Lord Frederick Cavendish, had also gone out to the North just before the war in 1860. He'd gone to America, he'd gone to the North, he'd travelled around the South, and he had come back completely pro-Northern. His views remained unchanged. And the two of them fell out deeply over the war and over the meaning of the war. Hartington came back saying that the American war is about the right to self-determination. It's the right for the freedom of nations to choose whether to stay or belong to a larger entity. And Lord Frederick said, that's not true. The American war is about the rights of individuals and whether one individual has the right to take away the freedom of another. And I thought, this is absolutely fascinating, because here we have, in the microcosm, what was going on in the macrocosm here in the United States. Families divided against each other, families divided over the meaning of the war, families divided over the meaning of freedom. And I thought, this is what I want to study next. I want to see how deep this went. Is it just the Cavendishes, just the Devonshire family, or is it others? And as I looked into it, I realized that this sense of division, this passion about the war, actually was very widespread and very deeply felt. And that it wasn't just Hartington and Lord Frederick, but actually 50,000 British men who volunteered for the war, most of them for the North, but a very sizable minority for the South, which was remarkable when you think that it was impossible to get to the South. There was a federal blockade of southern ports. There was no bounty waiting for them once they arrived, and yet they came anyway. And it now seems counterintuitive that so many young men would take Hartington's view that one form of freedom trumped another, and that they were freedom fighters by fighting for the South. So what I'd like to do today is briefly discuss two of these volunteers, two of these young men who volunteered for the South, in order to see if there's something about what they said and did which can illuminate what it was that was going through their heads that made them feel they were making the honourable choice by fighting for the South. And my first volunteer is a young man called Henry Weems Fielden. Now, Henry was 21 when the war broke out, and he'd had a very privileged upbringing. He was the son of a baronet, Sir John Fielden. He lived up north in a lovely grand house. He'd gone to an English boarding school, and then he had, after he graduated, he had joined the British Army and entered the Black Watch, a very famous Scottish regiment. And he had taken part in one of the greatest and I think saddest moments in Anglo-British history, which was the Indian Mutiny, and taken part in putting that down. And he had seen in the course of that year some of the worst atrocities ever committed, either by British soldiers or by the Indians, and many people never recovered from that. But the interesting thing for Henry is that instead of coarsening him or turning him into some kind of psychotic monster, it actually, according to his friends, made him more sympathetic towards the downtrodden, towards people he felt were victims in society. One of his great friends was the poet Algernon Swinburne. And Swinburne wrote of him to say, "I defy you not to like him if you knew him. He's one of the nicest fellows alive, and full of admiration, as such a man would be, for all fallen causes and exiled leaders." So I think that the uphill nature of the Confederates' struggle appealed to Henry's sense of chivalry. So when he heard about the federal blockade of southern ports, he resigned his commission. He got together a shipment full of supplies, included medicines, uniforms, arms, bullets, daily necessities, and he joined a flotilla that was going across the Atlantic and broke the blockade and sailed into Charleston. And once he arrived there, he distributed this cargo and then went down to Richmond to volunteer. And this is what he wrote once he arrived. He wrote, "The city is one great camp, and the demand for appointment as officers is enormous. I saw at once that my chance of getting a military appointment was very small indeed. I paid a visit to the Secretary of War, presented my letters to him, and was told that a good number of Englishmen had already come out to this country and, with very rare exceptions, been obliged to volunteer until they had proved themselves fit for a commission. I thought this was going to happen to me, but today I have been informed by President Davis himself that I have been appointed captain and assistant adjutant general. I shall be going to Charleston to serve under General Beauregard, because we daily expect the whole force of the Yankee Armada to be thrown against that portion of the state." But before he left Richmond, he had one more commission to fulfill, and that was to deliver a box of presents put together by English admirers for General Stonewall Jackson. So he set off, and it was a terrible day, terrible. And he was soaked to the skin by the time he arrived. And amazingly, when he got there, Jackson himself greeted Henry. And according to Henry, "He took off my wet overcoat with his own hands and made a fire for me whilst my boots were drying. We had a very pleasant conversation until dinner time, when we were joined by the other members of his staff. And when it was time for me to leave, I found the general still trying to dry my coat for me. Goodness, to think that in the midst of his duties, with the cares of a vast army on his shoulders, he found the time to carry out these little acts of thoughtfulness for me." Now, this excerpt is part of a much, much longer letter about his encounter with Jackson. And what's important about it is two things. First of all, it's the only letter we have written by a foreigner that is able to describe Jackson at such close quarters. And the second is that it was also the last, because 6 weeks later, he was killed at the Battle of Chancellorsville. As for Henry, he went off to Charleston, where he took up residence at in a boarding house run for and by English blockade runners. And this actually rather pleased him quite a lot, because, as he confessed to his aunt, until then, he had been subsisting on the diet of ordinary southerners, which was coffee made out of rye, or else just water for breakfast, crackers and old bacon for lunch, tough meat for dinner. My dear aunt, the people of the South are suffering very much for the want of good food. But shortly after this, he cheered up considerably because the long-awaited bombardment of Charleston took place. And as you all know, this one was a complete fiasco. And this made him so confident that he decided to convert his entire life savings into Confederate currency while it was still cheap to buy. But about this time, the very celebrated English colonel, Arthur Freemantle, arrived in Charleston. Now, he's since been immortalized in Michael Schara's Killer Angels and in the film Gettysburg. In fact, he's all over the place because he was a colonel in the Coldstream Guards and he just wanted to see the war. So he took a leave of absence and he traveled for 3 months through the southern states and he saw Gettysburg, for example, and he recorded it all. And anyway, but luckily, he also got to Charleston and he was shown around the city by Henry. And Freemantle thought this was hilarious because he'd gone to Sandhurst, the military college, with Henry's older brother. And he just couldn't get over the fact he was Fielding younger in a Confederate uniform. So he recorded everything Henry said. And apparently Henry was very enamored with all things Southern, but especially its women. Henry said, "The more I see of the Southern ladies, and the more I hear of their actions, of their grand heroism, of their sacrifices, of their sufferings, the more I am lost in astonishment. Words cannot express my admiration of them." So, as you can imagine, it was only a matter of time before one lady was going to capture his full admiration. And she was called Miss Julia McCord. And she'd come to Charleston in order to seek help in getting a military pass to visit her brother. Now, she had a rather interesting pedigree. She came from a very wealthy family. Her father was a congressman, the notorious Handsome Davy, James McCord. And I think that the apple didn't fall very far from the tree. She was apparently very beautiful. And she went into Henry's office to get this little pass, and sparks flew, something happened, who knows. But something clearly did happen because she kept that little military pass among her most prized possessions for the rest of her life. And very soon they started writing to each other all the time. And you can certainly see by their letters that they are so blinded with love that they don't seem to notice what's going on around them. Julia never mentions the fact that she can no longer buy shoes or clothes, that doesn't seem to notice that the southern economy is shrunk by 50%. Henry never seems to remark on the fact that when officers around him fall ill or die, they're never replaced. The South can no longer replenish its armies and is increasingly turning to guerrillas, raiders, partisan rangers. But interestingly, this is how my next volunteer entered the war. And his name is Bennett G. Burleigh. And Burleigh came from Scotland. He was a Glaswegian. And he was only 22 years old, and his father had sent him off. His father was a man called Robert Burleigh, and he owned a very profitable iron factory in Glasgow, which he had inherited from his father. But he didn't want to be a factory owner. He was a very frustrated man. He wanted to be an inventor. And all his life, he'd been inventing things and registering the patents, and nothing ever came of them. But he kept at it. And at the beginning of the war, he had designed what he called a torpedo, what we would call a limpet mine. But he called it a torpedo. And he tried to get the British interested in it, and they weren't. They paid no attention. So he gave the plans to his son and told him to go to the South. He thought that, you know, they were struggling, small nation, maybe they'd be more receptive to new ideas. So off Burleigh went, he arrived, got down to Richmond, and discovered they were not that receptive. In fact, they threw him into prison as a spy. But then, amazingly, Southern charm worked its magic even there in Castle Thunder, because very shortly Burley had become converted to the Southern cause. He volunteered. He offered to make the torpedo at his own expense and go off on a mission and show how it worked. And, you know, the Southerners said, oh, fine, okay, if you want to do that, go ahead. So they let him out, and he was given the wherewithal to put one together. And off he went on a mission. And then he discovered that his father's plans had one fatal design flaw, which was the torpedo wouldn't explode. So that was the end of his career as an arms entrepreneur. But he had volunteered. He had volunteered. Richmond, they did not accept him in the army, which said volumes considering the shortages. They took him into the navy, and since the South didn't have any ships, they didn't think that was really he was going to do much damage there. But he had come across a young man called John Yates Bell. It's written Beale, but it's pronounced Bell. He was a Virginian, and he was already a war hero. He'd been invalided out of the army. But he wanted to carry on fighting. So he'd come up with this very bold plan to conduct raids on the Chesapeake Bay in order to interrupt federal supply shipping. And he suggested this plan to the Secretary of the Navy, Stephen Mallory, and Mallory just felt that he could not spare anything for this raid. He thought, you know, it might do something, but it wasn't part of his plan. So he said to Bell, look, fine, I'm not going to stop you. Do your raiding, but you can't have any men, no volunteers, who are liable to be conscripted, which meant no Southerners aged between 19 and 40. And if you do find anybody, they're going to have to supply their own kit. And as for pay, they'll just have to pay themselves out of the ships that you capture. Anyway, so Bell went ahead, and he managed to scrape together 19 volunteers, of which Burley was one of them. So off they went, and they started conducting their raids, and actually, they were very successful. And after a few months, Washington became so annoyed, they sent down a joint military and naval expedition to smash this little raiding party, and smash they did. And in November 63, 19 of the 20 were captured. One managed to escape free and clear, and that was Burley. And he got down to Richmond, and he suddenly felt just a little bit shaken up. You know, this had been a somewhat trying experience to see all his comrades captured like that. And so he thought he'd take a break from fighting, and he joined the Southern Illustrated News. And he liked that very much. He was very happy there until the paper ran out of ink. And then he was out of a job. But down the road, the New Richmond Theatre was auditioning for a play called The Gorillas. And since he'd just been one, he thought he had a very good chance of getting a part. And so did they. So he became a fake gorilla for a few months. He liked that very much. But then, you know, the play closed. And he thought he'd go back to real guerrillaing again. And so he found a new outfit run by Captain Fitzhugh Lee. And he was having a great time until a federal scouting party surprised him while he was cutting their telegraph lines. And, they didn't take very kindly to that, as you can imagine. And they roughed him up and then sent him up to Fort Delaware, where he was told this was going to be his home for the rest of the war. While Burley was, shall we say, somewhat ruefully contemplating his lot, Henry and Julia were celebrating theirs. They were ecstatic because they had become engaged. And Henry wrote to her, Julia, to say, "You will trust me, dearest, won't you, to love you ever as I do now. Whatever happens, if I am alive, you will be protected, darling, by someone who will think of nothing else for the rest of his life but of making you happy." And he closed that particular letter by begging her to forgive him if he didn't write to her every day, twice a day. But for the moment, Charleston was under continuous bombardment, and it was difficult for him to post letters. And this was true. It was. And in fact, had been now continuously shelled for 8 months. And this was driving everyone in the town to distraction. And so the general, who is now in charge, General Jones, decided the way to counteract this was to move the high-ranking federal officers who were in Upper Charleston down to Lower Charleston directly in the line of fire. And for Henry, this was a terrible shock. This was not the way he had envisioned Southern chivalry. And he felt that it contravened the laws of warfare as he understood it. So he protested. He wrote an official protest to Richmond, which obviously was ignored. And so then he put on his best uniform and went down to the prison himself to make sure that these prisoners weren't actually being blown to smithereens. And he talked with one particular northern general, General Seymour, and was very impressed and came back and wrote to Julia to say, "My darling Julia, I had hardly ever met a Yankee before, and never a Yankee general, and had thought that the contact would make one's flesh crawl. But strange to say, I could not blow General Seymour from a gun or hang him without a good deal of repugnance. Indeed, I felt more inclined to ask him to dinner and show him around Charleston." His conscience was satisfied, but his protest cost him his promotion. And from then on, every time his superior officers recommended him for a promotion, it was countermanded by Richmond. And he stayed at the lowly rank of captain for the rest of the war. But that didn't stop them, I have to say, from sending him out on increasingly dangerous missions. And one of them, in summer of 64, involved him being sent down to Florida to round up deserters. And this was the kind of mission where you were just as likely to get shot in the back as you were in the front. But he survived. He found one or two who he managed to persuade to come up with him and rejoin the army. And when he got to Charleston, he was absolutely shocked to discover that Atlanta had fallen. He had no idea. But this convinced him that he and Julia must get married immediately because, as he said to her, as he explained, if he were to be killed now, then at least she would have a widow's pension to keep her going. So, unfortunately, by now, he had only one gold sovereign left. So he gave it to a jeweler and asked him to turn it into two rings, one for him and one for her. And they had a party for the wedding, but it was a very small party, as you can imagine. There was very little to celebrate at this point. But halfway through the evening, someone arrived and spread this incredible news, which was that something very important, something that was going to change the war, was about to happen in Canada. Now, I had no idea what that was, but it cheered everyone up considerably. Now, it so happens that we do know what that rumour was referring to because it involved our friend Bennett G. Burleigh. As it turns out, Burleigh had found himself in the most disgusting cell in Fort Delaware. In fact, he realised his cell was absolutely 100 times more disgusting than anyone else's. And it took him a while to figure out what the problem was. And then he discovered that the entire prison's sewage pipe went directly underneath his bed. But then this gave him an idea. And so one very dark and very stormy night, he and five friends got together. They shunted the bed out the way. And then, timing their blows with the peals of thunder, they broke open the floorboards and then broke open the pipe. And the six of them crawled through 125 yards of raw sewage in pitch black. But four of them drowned in that pipe in the sewage. Only two made it out alive, and obviously Burleigh was one of them. And then he flopped into the Delaware River and was miraculously picked up by a passing fishing boat, who then dropped him off in Philadelphia. And he then somehow managed to make his way through the north into Canada, which was then British North America and neutral territory. So once he was there, he could be out in the open. It was a safe haven for Confederate refugees. And he was walking down the street in Toronto when he just bumped into John Yates Bell. He had no idea that Bell was even there. And Bell was just thrilled to discover him because he had come up with this plan and he needed a deputy. And the plan was to liberate the 3,000 Confederate officers who were on a prisoner of war camp in Johnson's Island in the middle of Lake Erie. And Bell was convinced it would be very easy to do, or relatively easy anyway, because Lake Erie was only guarded, the whole of Lake Erie, by one ship. That was it. It was the USS Michigan, which was a pathetic 9-gun ship. And whoever had control of the ship would then have control over the whole lake. And so Bell's plan was to hijack a passenger ferry, and which would then be used to carry the prisoners off the island and away, and then to have another team that was to disable the Michigan. So Burley and Bell and a small team went off, and they captured the Philo Parsons, they turfed off the passengers, and they then sailed up towards Johnson's Island, where they expected their colleague, Lieutenant Cole, to have done his part. Now, the problem with Lieutenant Cole was that he was very, very good at a few things. He was very, very good at drinking. He was pretty good at spending other people's money. He was actually very bad at fighting. And so his method for disabling the Michigan was to offer a bribe to the captain, which led to his immediate arrest and the exposure of the entire mission. So that when Bell and Burley steamed up with the Philo Parsons, they found the Michigan with its sort of engines running and its gun ports open, and 50 Marines with their rifles trained on them. So this was just not what they wanted at all. So they abandoned the mission, they abandoned the ship and tried to run away. But this time, Burley's luck ran out, and he was very quickly captured and then extradited to Detroit, where he was going to be tried for the crime of piracy, which in those days was a capital crime. So, he was being tried for his life. But obviously he was worried. But he wasn't completely worried, because it was February 1865, and he thought, the war would end very soon, if not next week, the week after, or in a couple of weeks. And then he thought, passions would calm down, bygones would be bygones, they'd probably ship him back to England, it'd be all right, obviously, this was not an attitude shared by Henry Fielden. He still ardently supported the South, and he left Charleston along with the retreating Confederate army and accompanied General Hardee to the last ditch stand, the last great large-scale battle of the war, the Battle of Bentonville, on the 19th of March, 65, where he was determined to make that stand with his fellow officers. And he'd become very close to Hardee, who at that point was now quite ill with dysentery and sort of struggling. And then to complicate matters, Hardee's only son had arrived on the 18th. He was a 16-year-old boy. And this boy was distraught at the idea of missing the war. And so he somehow managed to persuade his somewhat distracted father to let him take part. And so Hardee asked Henry to keep an eye on his son, and which he tried to do. But he couldn't stop the boy from joining the Texas Rangers, where they made their famous charge. And, of course, the boy was one of the first to be shot down, shot through the chest, and was killed instantly. And then Henry got the next bullet. But amazingly, it just grazed him. He couldn't believe his luck. And so as soon as he could, he wrote to Julia to let her know that he was still alive. And he wrote to say, "My dearest Julia, I love you. I love you, if possible, more and more every hour. Oh, my precious one, if we are only spared to meet again and live together, what happiness this will be. I don't care how poor we may be. Just the two of us being together will be the greatest blessing this earth can afford us. Now, I have to say, that attitude was very good and very positive, because after the war, they were incredibly poor. They were so poor that they ended up living in a disused train carriage. And they stuck it out for about 18 months, and then they just couldn't cope. And so they went home. They went back to England and made a new life for themselves there. Henry rejoined the army and had a good career, and then he left and became, I kid you not, a very successful Arctic explorer and found several rare birds, you know, and that kind of thing. And then, you know, finally retired, and he inherited a little bit of money, and he moved into a house that was next door to Rudyard Kipling's. And the two of them became the best of friends, and they'd go shooting and fishing every weekend. And this lasted for over 20 years. And then finally, in the 1920s, when Henry eventually died, Kipling wrote to say, "This ends for me a dear friendship with one of the kindest, wisest, bravest, and most lovable of English gentlemen ever born. And there is no one to take his place for me." So that's Henry for you. You're probably wondering what happened to Bennett G. Burleigh. Well, Burleigh, he was tried for the crime of piracy, and it was a hung jury. And so they decided that, obviously Detroit was not the place to do this. And so they moved him further north to a small town called Clinton. And they just put him in the local prison there, and he waited, and he waited. It was a very small town, so everyone got to know about the British prisoner, in the town jail. And he got to know the jailer, he got to know the jailer's daughter, and and the months rolled by, and then it was September 65, and there was still no sign of this new trial, but it was his birthday. It was going to be 23. And this brought him several presents, including one, which was an apple pie, baked specially for him by the jailer's daughter. And it turned out, indeed, to be very special, very special. Because in the middle was a miniature saw. And so in the night, he just very quietly sawed his way out of the prison and then tiptoed, leaving everything behind. He just tiptoed out. And that was it. They just disappeared into thin air. They had no idea what had happened to him. Until about a year later, the jailer, not the daughter, I'm afraid, the jailer received a letter from Burleigh, postmarked Cape Town in South Africa. And it said, "Dear sir, I would be very grateful if you could please forward on to me my books, as I have been appointed the foreign correspondent for the London Daily Telegraph." So that's what became of Burleigh. And so the question is really, how did these two completely charming, nice, sane, liberal young men end up fighting for the South? And I can very briefly give you three reasons for this. The first is that, as you know, at the beginning of the war, the Secretary of State, William Henry Seward, believed genuinely that there were pockets, large pockets, of pro-Union sentiment in the South, and that all he needed to do was to find some way of releasing it, and that would forestall secession sentiment. And so he had to think, what could that be? And he was quite certain that the only sentiment that was stronger than support for secession, the only sentiment that united all Americans, was hatred of England. And if he could just whip up something, the threat of a war with England or England threatening war with America, he'd bring everyone back together again. And so he tried very hard to do that. And obviously it did not have an effect in the South, but it did have an effect on putting off the British, who at the very beginning of the war had offered themselves up as willing allies and then retreated into being hostile neutrals. So the good publicity at the beginning of the war turned into very, very, very bad publicity very shortly thereafter. And the South took advantage of this, having started out on the back foot, being, you know, slave owners, suddenly saw that there was an open door for them. And they went into Britain and they said, you know, the North are hypocrites. We are fighting for freedom. The North is fighting for empire, for territory. And then came Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which was understood so differently in Europe and abroad, especially in Britain. As soon as it came out, it was pointed out that it only freed the slaves in rebel-held territories. It did not free the slaves in the border states. And this being England and not America, there was no one to explain to British readers what the complicated domestic politics were behind this. They just assumed that the South was right. The North were hypocrites. They wanted to start a race war. This had nothing to do with actually bringing freedom to the slaves. And this allowed people, to Southern propagandists, to then start to say, we are freedom fighters. It is your moral obligation to support us, not those terrible tyrannical people up north. And at the word freedom fighter, it was very interesting. Suddenly, all university undergraduates supported the South, as did most academics. Then the theatre, most actors, actresses, writers, directors, they all supported the South. Then most writers, not all, but most, including Dickens and Thackeray and Darwin, a great number, they all supported the South. And then social campaigners, including Bishop Wilberforce, the son of William Wilberforce, who campaigned to abolish slavery. He too supported the South. How could this be? Well, because there was one obviously vital question, which was, what about slavery? And the Southern envoys have been instructed to answer it in a way that would be accepted by the British, which was that they said, you cannot ask the South to broach these sorts of questions while it's fighting for its survival. But after the war, we will deal with the slavery question. And of course, that word deal is a very slippery word. For those of you who have seen that 1960s Twilight episode, Twilight Zone episode, when the aliens come down to this Earth and they bring them a book that is entitled How to Serve Humanity, and it's a cookbook. You know, these words can mean different things. So the British interpreted, you know, we will deal with slavery in one way, the wrong way, but this enabled them to keep this fiction going. And very soon, Americans, Northerners who came to England realized that they had lost the moral high ground completely, and that it was morally fashionable to support the South. So what does this all mean? What does it mean today? Well, I have to tell you that the lesson I've taken from this is twofold. First of all, I think that this country can never, ever ignore public opinion, that there is no conflict that can escape the necessity of communication abroad. But more importantly is that even when these issues seem to be absolutely morally clear-cut in this country, it is very easy for that moral to be turned on its head, for the morality to be completely subsumed by other fashionable interpretations. And that all of us, including myself, can become victims of this. And when I personally support a campaign, I now do ask myself, am I being moral, or am I merely being morally fashionable? Thank you very much.